Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. We can talk about migrating birds, hunting, outdoor recreation, and a whole lot more with our guest, Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Comes by every other month to talk about the great outdoors. And I hope you will join in. I'm sure he does as well. Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email with a question and or photo as well to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you by phone or by email. And Scott Craven, welcome back.
Hi, Larry. It's great to be back.
So we've got some birds that are already thinking about migrating.
Yeah, things are starting. You know, only coming on every other month. A lot of time goes by. 2/3 of the summer has passed since I was on the program last. Lots happened. Of course, another 2 months of life with COVID has also gone by as well, and lots of additional events canceled that normally I'd be trying to promote on the program, like our popular Colbert's workshop that we should be getting ready to host next week up at Kemp Station. That's gone by the boards along with many other things. But it still has been, from the standpoint of natural history and what's going on outdoors, I don't think the birds and mammals and turtles and so on and so forth have paid a great deal of attention to the COVID pandemic. So overall,
you're right about that.
Well, it's been a great growing season. You know, there's been some unpleasant heat, but overall the weather's been good. It's been great for the last few days, kind of a touch of September. And as you said, there's still lots of action among the birds, lots of action at feeders as young birds, particularly round eye feeders, grosbeaks, finches, woodpeckers, they're all coming in for the first time. Young deer and turkeys and other things are all out and about. So there's a lot of activity this time of year, but because of the great growing season and all the moisture until it's been dry around here fairly recently, it's jungle-like out there. So
yeah,
there's so much vegetative growth that it's hard to see some of these things that you know are out there, but you just don't see them very often. But
oh, man. You know, Dick and LaCrosse asked if house wrens, you know, we're talking about birds here, house wrens, do they nest more than once a year? Dick wants to know.
Yeah, they may have a couple of broods. Quite a few birds will raise multiple broods. Couple of, hang on a second here, Larry.
Have you got a duck quacking in the background there?
Oh, that's my son calling from Denver, and I just cut him off. So with any luck, he'll call his mother's cell phone next. But anyway, that's life broadcasting from home, I guess.
But they do, right?
Oh, yeah, multiple broods. So some birds, wrens included, will have a couple of broods normally. Things like mourning doves that are very prolific may have even more than that. And other birds that normally have a single brood or a single clutch, and then if that's successful, then they have young, they won't nest again. But if they lose the clutch of eggs or the brood of young birds for some reason, then they're geared up to re-nest, have a second nest later in the season. So there are all sorts of things continuing out there. And in the case of turkeys, for example, the ones that I've seen around the yard here, I've got one hen coming in with five young ones that are about the size of chickens, and then another hen with only one poult that's only about the size of a quail. Tiny little thing. So that was obviously a recent hatching, even here in August. So these events are spread out over quite a lengthy period, but it's all winding down now. People will notice that they're not hearing much bird song anymore. The singing has gone away. There are signs of molting once the adult birds have a brood with them, like the turkeys, for example. They'll start to molt their old feathers. And again, around the yard, I've noticed all sorts of turkey feathers lying around. As they tend to molt in sequence with the young birds developing, that's particularly important with waterfowl because ducks and geese lose the ability to fly during the molt. So they time that so that they're not flying at the same time the young birds are developing flight, and they both attain flight at about the same time. So lots of things going on, but the nesting season for all species has pretty well come to an end.
Yeah, but migration is picking up for some birds anyway.
Yes, some birds that starts in July. Shorebirds in particular are kind of the first to gather up and hit the flooded fields and wetlands and head south, followed by flycatchers and a few other species. And then there are other birds like the blackbirds and some of the swallows and other insect eaters that start to gather up rather than being distributed around the landscape for the nesting season. And visiting feeders and so forth, they gather up in large flocks in preparation for migration. So some have started, some are staging and getting ready for it. Some will be here well into the fall, and of course there'll be the usual wondering, when are those poor hummingbirds going to leave? I better stop feeding them. But that won't occur for some time. So most of our birds will still be around for the better part of 1.5 to 2 months to enjoy and keep us company. And then the resident birds, of course, will be here through the winter.
Lee in Portage has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Lee.
Hi, guys. Hey, great show. I've taken a loving to birds. And one question I have, first of all, do you have a good migration site to watch? I picked a number of them out online, and it's amazing to see the migration of the birds when they leave, say, Mexico and catch the jet stream and come up to Wisconsin, but then also I wanted to comment on orioles.
Okay. You got a website, Scott, that you would go to for checking on the migrating birds?
Well, there are a lot of different webcams around that will allow people to monitor a given site or feeder, for example. And by lack of activity or activity, you can kind of gauge what's going on. It's difficult to actually catch the birds in the act of migration. Many of them fly at night. So you either see, you know, it's a here today, gone tomorrow kind of phenomenon where there might be large flocks of something around and the next day they're gone, depending on the weather conditions that drive them along. There are a couple of places to check out that usually offer listings of a variety of webcams and websites. The eBird website is one, and that deals a lot with Wisconsin stuff. The Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology is another one. And there's a lot of bird information and birding programs offered by the Wisconsin Natural Resources Foundation. And they have some sites up on their website as well. And I think there's probably a check with the DNR. They have a couple of bird-related groups that post regular updates on what's going on, so a search of the DNR website will likely turn up some good secondary websites or webcams that the person can enjoy. And the second part of their question was
relating to orioles, I believe. Lee, are you still there?
Yeah, I was going to say I'm going broke. No, not really, but I've continually fed the orioles this summer, which is odd to me. Usually they'll take off and they won't come back. And I've been, I think I went through 15 quarts of grape jelly at my house this year already, feeding these orioles. And I live right across the river from the Wisconsin River in Portage. So they seem to go over the island and nest and they come back and forth. So in town, I got males and females coming, you know, all day long.
Wow.
Well, they're beautiful birds, and of course they're very popular then around the backyard because of their color, and they have a pretty song as well. But for whatever reason, Lee, and I have no explanation for it, some people seem to get them for a longer period. Historically, I put the jelly feeder out as soon as we see the first oriole, and then that goes until, usually sometime late May or June, and then they've dispersed to nest and do oriole things, and they pretty much disappear, and I bring the oriole feeder in. But this year, I was still filling it well into mid-July and still had orioles around. The only reason it comes to mind for me is I was at the grocery store buying another couple of two pound jars of the most inexpensive jelly I can find. And the Orioles, feeding Orioles, pretty widely known and participated in phenomenon. And the clerk at the grocery store said she saw all this grape jelly, and you know, she didn't suggest we were having a big party for the kids with PB&J sandwiches. She immediately said, "What? You still have Orioles this time of year?" And I said, "Yes, I do." And I got through another 2 pounds, and I just brought the Oriole feeder in. I noticed that the last remnants of the jelly had dried up, and no one had paid any attention to it. So I just brought it in literally a week or so ago. So it was an extended feeding period, but that's I think that's a good thing in most people's minds. But typically, it's a lot shorter for most people than it was this year.
Yeah. Lee, thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too, by the way. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you can email us, like a lot of people are doing right now, at ideas@WPR.org. Chris in Oregon, Wisconsin, emailed that he has observed many more rabbits running around this spring and early summer. Also, many more amphibians, frogs and toads. He wonders if COVID has played a role in this, with less car traffic on our local roads during April and May.
Well, there's been a lot of talk, Larry, about what COVID did, or especially early on, primarily when we were in shutdown mode and the streets were fairly quiet, people were inside, and this was a global phenomenon. And there were lots of accounts of things like wild goats moving into rural communities in Europe, and people seeing more things active and seemingly with less concern about human presence. But I think most of that impact, while I'm sure that saved some animals in terms of roadkill, I'm not sure we can attribute the current abundance of rabbits and amphibians to that. I think the amphibian situation relates to the tremendous rains we've had over most of the state, again, until recently. I think July around Madison was the 12th or 14th wettest July in history, and the spring was very wet. There are still temporary lakes. I say temporary, they're almost becoming permanent around me here in Oregon, where Chris was calling from, that were formerly bean fields or corn fields or whatever else, and they're still holding water. So life is good if you're an amphibian. There are plenty of breeding locations, and I think they took advantage of that. So a good year from the amphibian standpoint. As far as the rabbits are concerned, the abundance of vegetation that I mentioned earlier has provided them with tremendous cover. They're pretty much able to escape from any immediate problems by ducking into dense prairie vegetation or undergrowth along the roadsides or whatever. And I think Chris's observation is correct. And since I live in the town of Oregon as well, I'd have to confirm that rabbits have been a major thorn in the side in my garden. And I usually start to leave them alone by this time of year because there's more in the garden than we can use anyway. But I notice along the driveway now and the roadside, they're out, and they're out in abundance, and they're out at times of day when typically you wouldn't expect them. The early morning or twilight, yes, but I'm starting to see them at other times of the day. So that's a good sign that there are a lot out there. But I don't think we can give much of the credit in that case to COVID, and a lot of credit to the vegetation, food supply, and the fact that, oddly enough, rabbits breed like rabbits. So
there you go.
They can fill an empty niche pretty quickly.
Scott Craven, our guest today, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. Talking the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in today. Lots of callers online. I think we'll go to the phone, Scott, and see who's there. Lynn in Pleasant Lake, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. We have red-headed woodpeckers, and they had two children, and we know this because they brought them to the suet feeders to teach them how to eat out of the suet feeders. Then this weekend, there was this huge fight all day long where the adults were, like, fighting with the kids, we think. Is that possible? Do they fight like that to make the kids go away and find their own home?
Probably not. But sometimes what we interpret as fighting is actually something else. And in some cases, it really is aggression. But it's often difficult to tell who's who amongst the various squirrels and birds that are at a given feeder. So it may not always be the parents of the young that we think we're seeing, as opposed to perhaps other birds, not necessarily in your case, because red-headed woodpeckers are very uncommon, and not a very common feeder bird either. Can you describe the birds for me, the adults?
Well, it's mostly just the size. I mean, they're black and white and have the red head, and they look like handkerchiefs when they fly. The one, the two were fighting, and they absolutely fell out of the sky to the ground. Like in a swirl, fighting with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of kept up all day long, where they kept going from their home, which is in an oak tree, and flying back and forth across the property all day. And they were like dive bombing each other. So it was like a pair against a pair.
Hmm. And it was two adults and two young ones.
Hmm?
The two pairs consisted of two adults and two young ones.
That's what I felt, because the other two were not as big as the other two. And the adults were the ones that kept going back into the hole and protecting the hole in the oak tree and wouldn't let the other ones go back in.
Well, I'm not sure what to say about that, because, it could have been an attempt by parents to drive the young off on their own, but that seems a little extreme. Do you by any chance have any pictures you could send us of either, you know, if they're right there on the feeder, either the adults or the young, or better yet, them together, just to make sure that we're not seeing a couple different species mingling and interacting or something else going on?
I do have some pictures, so I can give that a try. These red-headed woodpeckers, after there was the fire in the wetland area not too far from us, they showed up and they took over this hole in the oak tree that this poor red-bellied woodpecker had been working on for 6 weeks.
Well, that seems a little harsh, but so you're pretty familiar with red bellies too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Then I don't think there's any case of mistaken identity here, except perhaps the young. But I would think that I'm not sure I've ever actually seen a young redheaded up close and personal. So you probably know more about that than I do. But
email us a picture.
Send a picture just for the heck of it. And Larry likes to get these and post them so other folks listening in can see some of the species we're talking about. And redheadeds are, again, not particularly common. And they're a beautiful bird, and that'll give other people a chance to have a look at them. In terms of what's going on, it could be a squabble between parents and young, or the adults just trying to get the young off on their own. But, fighting or disagreement to the point that they're locked together and driven to the ground seems a little extreme. So
yeah, it does.
I can't give you a thorough explanation for that.
Shoot a photo to us at ideas@wpr.org, Lynn, and we'll take a look. It'd be interesting to see. Diana in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Diana.
Hi. First, I wanted to say that, yes, that the vegetation is incredibly lush this year. As far as seeing birds, I was taking my walk and noticed about 20 feet from me a head of a turkey just sticking up. And I stopped to look at it, and sure enough, in the brush below were these tiny little turkeys just walking around, and, you know, she was just protecting them, and it was quite fun to see. But my question is that for the first time I've ever seen this sort of, first it was this caramel colored bird at my bird bath in my backyard with a reddish head. It almost looked kind of coral. And then another bird came with it, I assume the male, because it was a little darker brown, and the head was darker. And when I saw the wings open up, I've been watching them, it's reddish, matching the head. I have never seen these birds before, and they have been coming to the bird bath all summer. And I think there's more than just the pair, but they're beautiful, and I just don't know what they are. I've never seen them before.
Do you have a photo of those,
Diane? I don't. I'm sorry.
So that the when you said the wings appear red, is that the undersurface of the wings or the top of the wing?
Under the wings. I didn't notice the red until one of them got into the bath and they opened the wings up. And it actually looked like the red was on the back of the bird.
I'm stumped.
Well, the reason I asked about the undersurface is that grosbeaks, especially young ones, have a bright pinkish red on the undersurface of the wing that shows only when they fly. But that doesn't really match with the head color or what you're describing. I think, Diana, the best thing you can do, if you don't have a copy of something like the Peterson Field Guide to Eastern Birds, you can look at all of these things online and go to a field guide, and either by size or shape or whatever other characteristic you can use to get you to the right place in the field guide, thumb through some species that might meet the description. See if you can sort that out by looking at pictures in a field guide. And we also have a pool of very capable birder listeners out there that if the description rang a bell with anybody, this would be a good time to call in.
Yeah.
You never really know for sure what you're seeing. These can be uncommon birds, although if it seemed to be a pair, it's less likely to be an individual that was blown off course or caught up in a storm or whatnot. I noticed that there was a record of a very unusual hummingbird called a violet ear here in Wisconsin recently that attracted a fair bit of attention. It had only been seen a handful of times in the state. So you can't ever rule out the odd bird, so to speak, but if it seems to be a pair and they've been around for a long time, that suggests that they're something resident that just isn't coming to mind. How big were they compared to, say, a robin?
Oh, they were much smaller. We have a robin that comes, and it's just monstrous compared to the other birds. It was much smaller, somewhat between a finch and a robin, probably halfway between each.
But not a purple finch or a house finch that have a fair bit of red or violet on them. No, you're familiar with those.
Yeah. No, this the female, I'm guessing, had almost like a coral colored. That's what I noticed, because it was such a beautiful, this sort of coral colored and a chocolate colored light tan. And then the male was just the same markings, but just in a deeper reddish and then darker brown. And at first I thought it was just the head until they opened the wings, and it was just stunning.
Well, it sounds like a bird that should be pretty easy to tease out of the field guide. And I'm hopeful that one of the listeners who's thinking more clearly than I am right now is going to make the call for us over the rest of the at some time during the rest of the program. So check those field guides. I'm pretty sure with a thorough description like that, you should be able to pick it out of the lineup, so to speak.
Good luck, Diana. Thank you so much. Rod in Arlington, your turn. Hi, Rod.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is, we've had a very big bumper crop of chipmunks and squirrels this year, and I started live trapping chipmunks. I have a neighbor who has a woods. He lets me transport them down to, and I've already did 15 this spring. They seem to have had a second hatch of, what do you want to call it, hatching bunch of chipmunks, and I've got an overabundance again. What I wanted to know is it too late in the year to transport these down to the other woods for them to have sufficient time to put feed away for the winter?
No, I think you can still successfully do that. And whether someone's dealing with 13-line ground squirrels, which have been abundant this year, or chipmunks, or even gray squirrels, I think you could relocate them well into the fall. I mean, the options are not good. It's possible the relocated chipmunk may not have a lot of time to find shelter or whatnot, but they're pretty resourceful at that. And the option is to leave them to provide a good seed stock, so to speak, for next spring. Last year, just as an example, if you're persistent about this, I hit 26 moved, again, to a woodlot not too far away. But that pretty well took care of the problem. Once I hit number 26, I didn't see another chipmunk for the rest of late summer, about this time of year, and into fall. And now, fast forward to this summer, it was only about a month ago that I saw a chipmunk, and that's it. I still see him occasionally around our water garden. He's got a hole in the rocks there, but since it's only one individual, I've become fairly tolerant of the single chipmunk. But I think if you're persistent, I would keep at it, because if you don't, there's going to be who knows, a dozen or more already in place come next spring, and then you're just going to make next year's problem that much more difficult. So I'd keep after them.
There you go, Rod. Thank you for calling. Mo in Oconto, it's your turn. Hi, Mo.
Hi, guys. And I'd like to give a shout-out to John and Nick on the Peshtigo River. Here's my question, fellas. What do we know about the drumming reports for the rough grouse for this upcoming season? Do we know anything about that? And does it tend to make a difference on what part of northern Wisconsin, whether you're west, central, or eastern, if you're looking for that kingbird?
You know, Mo, that's a terrific question, because I'm always curious about that myself. Ordinarily, those drumming counts are released pretty regularly, but I'm thinking now that you've brought this up, I ordinarily get the DNR outdoor report electronically every Thursday, and that's a good source of information. Similarly, Outdoor News, the newspaper format publication, which is very informative on outdoor issues in the state, they're very good about publishing the grouse survey results. But frankly, I have not seen a thing, and I don't get the outdoor report right now. So I'm wondering if with COVID, a lot of this has been shut down. I'm not even sure the surveys were fully conducted. For example, some important surveys, like the waterfowl survey nationwide, that was scrapped because of COVID. And they're going to go with previous year's information and kind of bootstrap biology to deal with that this year. But to be honest with you, I don't know if the surveys were even conducted. I've just been going by what I either see myself when we're up at our cabin in Price County or talking to the local folks, the year-round residents up there, and I heard some reasonable reports about birds along the roadside or people hearing drummers during the spring, to the extent that most of the folks I talked to were optimistic, and it's been a good year weather-wise. Nut and berry production, it should be a good year for the adults and their young. So that's a bit encouraging. In answer to your question about does it matter where you are? It matters hugely where you are, because grouse, like all these other species we talk about, are not evenly distributed on the landscape. There'll be pockets of good cover, areas where there's been a lot of timber harvest over the last few years, or other things that affect grouse habitat that mean a lot of variance in the population from place to place. But I guess I'm going to have to do a little checking on the grouse counts and see if they were actually conducted, because this is probably the first year, now that you've brought it to my attention, that I've not seen anything released. Larry, have you heard or seen anything?
No, not a thing. I was running that through my brain, too, and I hadn't seen a thing.
Well, that's
something we should check on. Maybe somebody from the DNR is listening and can phone in and let us know.
Yeah, at least let us know if the counts were made, and if they were made, where's the information so that we can pass it along. So I have a feeling that some of this stuff, including maybe the outdoor report, have been suspended because of people not being in the office and dealing with the COVID situation. But, Mo, I'm really glad you brought that up, because now I'm really curious to know what's going on, and I know just the person to call. And if Tim Isley, if you're out there listening, Tim's a well-known outdoor writer in the state, and he usually is right on top of this. Tim, if you know anything about the grouse counts, give us a call.
Tim may well be listening. He often is, especially on these Wednesday programs. Mo, stay listening. We'll see what we can come up with. In the meantime, let's go to Bill in Oregon. Bill, hello.
Hi, Scott. Hi, Larry. Got two quick comments and a question. First one's about red-headed woodpeckers. They can be seen, not all the time, but along the bike trail between Fish Hatchery and the Oregon Business Park. There's a bunch of snags out over the water, and we have seen red-headed woodpeckers there. And a quick comment about rabbits in Oregon. Depending on where you've been living, there was a family of gray foxes that pretty much wiped him out for almost a year and a half, and we're just seeing a comeback of rabbits right around us. we saw very few for about almost 2 years. And
Bill, if you know where those gray fox are, and we could have heard them over by my property for a couple of weekends, I'd really appreciate that.
Oh, man. You had a question, too, didn't you, Bill?
Yep, quick question. And the question's about, I've been driving by the Oregon Farm Facility, and I'm not seeing any ringneck pheasants. And I was just wondering, has COVID impacted a lot of those programs as well?
Yes. I drive by the Oak Hill Facility pretty regularly myself, and I've been watching first the pens go up and then the mowing of the tremendous vegetation that was in the pens. And I drove by day before yesterday thinking, there might be some pheasants in there, but there were not. And I think that's just a matter of they've not been distributed yet. But that should happen over the next few weeks, so the birds will show up there. In regard to the impact of COVID, the biggest impact would be because of COVID. There were some challenges at the game farm at Poinette, and I believe that I heard that pheasant production was reduced from what we've had the past couple of years, which was around 75,000 birds ready to be put out on the state public hunting areas, down to about 50,000, a significant reduction. So even when the birds are present in the pens, there aren't going to be as many, Bill. I don't know how they've decided how to allocate the fewer birds that they have, whether it will just be a proportionate reduction to all the different areas that birds are released on, or whether they may eliminate stocking on some marginal areas in favor of some of the more heavily used sites. I don't know that. But there is a considerable reduction in the number of birds, and I think it's just a matter of time before they show up at Oak Hill. I know that other places that are raising birds, like the Dane County Conservation League, has a work day coming up in preparation for distributing birds to their members and getting those ready to be released along toward the end of the month. So I think we're just a little ahead of the curve in terms of seeing those birds.
There you go, Bill. Thank you for calling. Kurt in Brownsville, your turn. Hi, Kurt.
Oh, hi. I just had a comment about the lady that called in about the little brown birds with the reddish head. And we've had a a whole bunch of those, and they to me, they looked like sparrows. They're exact same size, and they were with a bunch of sparrows that were coming in on our feeders. And they had this, you know, they were brown, and they had this, you know, reddish head. And I looked in a field guide, and I couldn't see anything that would match them. And I just thought, well, maybe it's just some variation of the sparrow.
Huh? That could be possibly too, Scott. Although it doesn't seem likely red.
Larry, the sparrow doesn't sound right, but I've got Tim Isley on the other phone here. I'm going to ask him about the grouse counts. We'll see what we can find out.
In the meantime, I will remind everybody that our guest today is Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today on the program, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Always great to have Scott come by. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or phone 1-800-642-1234. And Scott was, he's a two-phone man, and he had Tim Isley on his other phone to bring us some information, perhaps, on grouse.
Yes, I'm sorry about the confusion, Larry. My wife tried to call Tim on the other phone, and then he called back while the phone was sitting in here. But to take care of Mo's question from El Condo, the grouse counts were not done. So we don't know. We're going to have to rely on anecdotal information from, like I was describing, from folks we know up north, the area wildlife managers who are out and about on the ground up there. But in terms of a data set to compare to previous years and know whether we're up, down, or maintaining the status quo, we're not going to have that. So
there we go.
That takes care of that one. As far as Kurt calling in from Brownsville about the mystery birds, they just didn't sound like sparrows to me, but when you're doing the news at the top of the hour, I'm going to quick run down to my office and grab a field guide and see if I can find anything that fits the bill. But again, for other listeners, what we're looking for is a medium-sized bird, little bigger than a finch, little smaller than a robin, with some coral coloration on it, apparently a pair, male a little bit darker, and some red on the wings and back. And that's just not getting me anywhere, but we'll try and figure something out. And I also need to get some help from the listeners on that turtle situation a little later, too. So,
okay. Well, Rachel in Gays Mills, I think, has some exciting news for us. Rachel, hello.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Scott.
Hello.
Hey, you just mentioned my exciting hummingbird feeder adventure this weekend. We're the family who had the Mexican violet ear show up on our hummingbird
feeder.
Fantastic. Yeah, my husband said, Larry's doing a migration show. Maybe they'll talk about the hummingbird. And you mentioned it, and so I thought I'd just give you a buzz.
How did you determine what it was?
Well, I was inside on Sunday morning, and I've got a feeder right outside my kitchen window. And it caught my attention just out of my periphery because it was so big compared to a ruby-throated hummingbird. And I turned and I called out to my daughter, what is that hummingbird? And she grabbed the field guide, and we were struggling to key it out, and then it was gone. And we got some terrible pictures just through the kitchen window, and I got a real camera ready, and it was back 15 minutes later, and we were able to make some notes of what we saw, and we couldn't quite figure it out. So I used to be a naturalist, so I posted it to my social media page and tagged some naturalist friends to help me, and someone posted it to the ABA Rare Birds page, and then my whole life blew up for about 48 hours. And the folks on the ABA page were able to identify it, and people just started calling to see if they could come and get a chance to see it. It was here all day Sunday from 8 in the morning till I went to bed, and then we saw it early Monday morning, and then it was gone by 7 a.m. We saw it for 2 hours on Monday, and then we didn't see it again. So I wanted to encourage folks in the driftless region, southwestern Wisconsin or the Iowa-Minnesota border, to keep their eyes out, because to me it's fascinating that no one else noted or there were no other recorded sightings of this bird, and it's traveled a really long way.
Yeah, it has indeed. And so I would, other people who are listening in, you might just go to your field guide and take a look at what a violet ear hummingbird looks like and be ready to maybe identify it. That's very cool. Rachel, thanks a lot for calling. I bet she was a busy gal there for a couple of days.
Yeah. Well, that's what happens when you're hosting a rare bird. People want to see it and add it to their life list. So that's pretty exciting.
Thank you, Rachel. Al in Vernon County, your turn. Hi, Al.
Hi, good morning, guys. Great show, and Scott's my favorite guest on.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Last month, I believe, in the discussion, if we saw bats in the area, we were supposed to make a contact. Do you have that information?
I suspect what you're referring to. I was not on last month, so that was probably something Jamie and David were talking about. But the DNR was running a bat count and wanted people to report where they were seeing bats so that they could track down roosts and breeding colonies and assorted other things. There was a press release put out by the DNR on that, dealing with counting bats. I don't have it in front of me, but I think if you go to the Natural Heritage Inventory, the bat team has that kind of information posted, and they also have a periodical newsletter called the Echo Locator that they produce, which would have, I'm sure, had an article about it in there. That's about all I can tell you about it, whether that's still going or not in terms of the data collection phase, I do not know.
Ah, there we go, Al.
But I think you can track that down. That was run by the BAT team within the former Bureau of Endangered Resources, which is now Natural Heritage. I think you can track that down if you want to spend a couple minutes online.
Yeah. Thanks, Al. Appreciate it. Lois in DeForest, your turn now. Hi, Lois.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I am working with a group. I live in DeForest. Working with a group has spotted a coyote, a fox with mange. And the person kind of in charge of trapping the fox with a large live trap is wondering how to do it to treat the fox with the mange. And they are wondering, is there a particular kind of food or whatever that would that the fox would go to in the trap?
Hmm. Well, Lois, first of all, is this just something a group of individuals have decided to try and do, or is this being orchestrated by a wildlife rehabilitator or someone who has some knowledge of the situation? Is it a Good Samaritan effort, or is it being orchestrated by someone involved in this kind of thing?
Well, all I know, Professor Craven, is that they have a wildlife rehabilitator ready to accept the fox.
Okay.
To treat
okay.
it. So.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, that's important. I mean, someone who knows what they're doing, if they can care for it and initiate the proper treatment, that's fine. I thought initially the way you were describing it was kind of a neighborhood effort or something. Hey, let's try and help that fox out. But as long as there's a rehabilitator lined up, then okay. As far as catching it's concerned, fox are reasonably general in their diet. They're good mousers, and of course catch a variety of prey, but you can't really use live animals like mice or whatnot for bait. So I would say in terms of capturing fox, the person with the most current experience that I can come up with is David Drake, my colleague on campus, who does the alternate month programs with Larry, with Jamie Knack. And David is in charge of the Urban Canid project here in the Madison-Dane County area. And he and his team of students and whatnot have been trapping fox and coyote with various techniques for the last several years and have attracted a lot of attention with that project. I would think that since you're in DeForest, which is kind of in the immediate range, that you might be able to get some help from David on this, at least some advice, if not more active involvement. So that's going to be my suggestion, is that you get a hold of David. Larry, can you transfer Lois to Jill to get David's contact information, or how would that best be handled?
I think if Jill just goes online and says and types in David Drake, Drake like the bird, UW Madison, his name and contact information is going to pop up right away.
Yeah, so Lois, that's my suggestion. I think David can give you some useful tips on catching this animal, and might be able to help. I don't know. He lives out in Middleton, not too far from you. That's between you and David. But that would be my advice. Getting any animal like that into a live trap, unless it's conditioned to do so, is always a little tricky. Placement of the trap is very important, and then bait selection with some type of a fresh meat bait. Although fox will eat a variety of things, that may be the best approach. But see if you can get a hold of David and see what kind of assistance he can provide you with.
There you go. That's a good advice, Scott. Craig in Cambridge, your turn. Hi, Craig.
Hello, gentlemen. I was calling because there's been two birds that were discussed trying to identify. One was the larger than a sparrow, smaller than a robin. I'm not positive about that one. But another gentleman called at his feeder. He had something that looked like a sparrow that had a red head, maybe a small red breast on it or some red. And I'm thinking that might be a house finch.
Yep, I think you're right on the feeder bird. House finch or purple finch, probably around here, house finches now. They're common at my feeders. But we kind of ruled that out. The other one that the woman had at a bird bath, a pair of them, didn't seem, she knew what finches looked like and ruled those out. So I think we've solved the sparrow-like bird on the feeder problem, but not the pair of unusually colored birds with the coral coloration that were on the bird bath. So thanks for helping out, Craig.
Yeah, appreciate it, Craig. Thank you so much. Matt emailed to say the only badger he's ever seen in Wisconsin was roadkill. Is there a part of the state where he's more likely to see a live badger? He says he spends a lot of time in Bayfield County. Is there a place up there?
Well, there's certainly nothing specific that I could suggest. Badgers are found statewide, and not in high numbers, but they are found statewide. And I would say that the best bet is to look for suitable habitat, open countryside, mixed farmland, hillsides, places where they're going to be a bit more visible if they are around. But having said that, I've covered a lot of ground in Wisconsin over the last almost 50 years now in the state in suitable habitat, and I've yet to see a live badger. So it's a low return proposition, Larry. And,
well, they like to spend time. I mean, they're moving at night a lot, aren't they? That's why we don't see them.
Well, that too. But usually when people have, over the years, have reported seeing them on the program, it's because they've found a den. And then they can kind of stake out the den with either a blind or trail cameras, or get the badgers used to them, and then have great viewing opportunities. But just seeing one kind of casually is not an easy proposition. As far as Bayfield specifically is concerned, I get a hold of the folks at the Great Lakes Visitors Center or the DNR offices and just ask and perhaps just by circumstance bump into somebody who's seen one, knows where there's a den, or something else that might help guide him to the sighting.
Yeah, that makes the most sense to me as well. Melanie spotted a solitary sandpiper in her farm in northeast Iowa. It was on the ground, unable to fly, and died a couple shortly thereafter, sadly. She wondered if they were would have been migrating.
Probably. I mean, that's the sandpipers and other shorebirds are about the earliest to gather up and start to head south, and stopping along moist ground and so forth in farmland is pretty commonplace to see them.
Yeah.
So that's certainly possible.
Yeah, summer range Canada, winters in Central and South America, and so forth. Well, Scott's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. You can join in at 800-642-1234. And we will be back with Scott right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at our wildlife in the state with Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. What questions do you have on your mind? Give a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Scott, I don't know if you had time to look in your birding book, for a bird ID, but did you find anything?
I did have time, Larry. I went through a couple of field guides, just a quick scan, and to be honest with you, I got nothing, Larry. there are some unusual things that would be unusual here in Wisconsin, that where the coral-colored head comes in, like a western tanager, and with birds that are around that seem to have the right size, rufous-sided towhee, an orchard oriole that's seen occasionally around here. I just don't know. In the absence of a picture, I think we're going to have to hope that that the caller can find something in a bird book that's going to ring a bell. But the violet ear hummingbird that we talked about earlier is just an example of how some really strange stuff can show up and kind of throw us a curveball. So
there you go.
So far, we're dead in the water.
Well, let's go to Melissa, find out what's on her mind in Ashland. Hi, Melissa.
Hey, good morning. I have a question for you about beavers.
Yeah.
Well, my husband and family have been fortunate to meet and get acquainted with a small beaver family on a 20-acre lake in Douglas County. And for about 5 years, we've been watching them build their lodge and survive some bitterly cold winters, and then they emerge in the spring with their little family. And they've just been fascinating to watch. They've been really curious about us, and they included us on their nightly patrols of the lake with a swim by our house to see what we were doing, as well as to show us their beaver life. And we've been recently just devastated to find out that our township hired APHIS to trap and kill all of the current family by setting traps on a connected wetland area next to our lake. We were told that the beavers clogged a culvert and APHIS was hired to kill them. So we'd like to know why the local or state policies or practices favor simply killing beavers instead of using other control measures to keep them alive and protect our infrastructure. There have to be other ways to live compatibly with our wildlife, and also we need some help explaining these wildlife practices that focus on killing and not other practices to protect wildlife.
All right, Melissa, thank you. Scott, a comment.
Well, that's I can both hear and I understand Melissa's being a little despondent over this particular decision since they've enjoyed interacting with the beavers for so long. But the reality of the situation, Larry, is that some of these management issues become very complicated. While individual animals can provide great joy and interest, collectively, some of these animals, beavers included, can be so abundant that they begin to cause some problems that other people who have perhaps not shared in the close association of the beavers are unwilling to tolerate. And that includes plugging culverts, which leads to road maintenance problems and sometimes costly repairs. It includes cutting timber in places where people don't want timber cut, and also causing flooding of some lands that people don't want flooded in parks, golf courses, settings like that. I don't know the specific setting here or how what the juxtaposition is of the lake that she was talking about and the wetland where the beavers seem to be causing some culvert problems, but it's quite common across primary beaver range to deal with these flooding and culvert problems by removing what would then be referred to as nuisance beaver. Whether one agrees with that or not, or likes it or not, it's the reality of efficiency in terms of dealing with these problems. In some cases, in other places or at other times, beaver may be dealt with or were at one point dealt with by capturing them alive in big wire mesh traps and moving them elsewhere. But again, with an abundant animal, it becomes difficult to find a place to put these nuisance animals where they aren't going to cause more problems or where the habitat isn't already saturated by the animal in question. This is not unlike problems in urban environments with tremendously abundant raccoons, possums, things like that. What does someone do with one when they catch it or remove it from their chimney or basement or under the deck or whatever? Where the heck are you going to put it where there aren't those animals already? So the live trap and removal alternative has kind of fallen out of favor. Some culverts were appropriate for installing what was called a beaver pond leveler. It was a pipe-like device that took water from above the beaver dam and actually ran it through the culvert and allowed the flow to continue and alleviate the flooding. But that was a mechanical issue, and some places were just not suitable for the use of that particular mechanical device. So I'm assuming that the people involved, the folks in Ashland who called for the control, and of course the USDA Wildlife Services people, she referred to them as APHIS, that stands for Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, but in any event, you know, they have a team of folks around the countryside who do this type of work when it's requested. And so there's two issues here. The folks from APHIS are just doing what they've been asked to do, and they're very good at it. The folks who made the decision are where Melissa might be able to question how or why that decision was made. But if it's in response to someone filing a complaint or the county road department just saying, hey, this is unacceptable, you know, it's getting too expensive to continue maintaining the road or the culvert or whatever, then I suspect it's a done deal. And it's not always the most popular decision, but that's the way it comes down.
Melissa, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have Nancy in Eagle River sent a photo or sent a comment about the bird that we were talking about earlier and wonders if it isn't a red pole.
That's
a possibility.
It's another possibility, but that's a bird that's even a little smaller than a finch. And the caller seemed adamant that it was, you know, it was closer to robin size than finch size. So Larry, if we've got a second here, I just wanted to, can I get a word in about the Great Outdoors Act?
Yeah, sure.
I just wanted to let people know it's been in the paper the last couple of days. It's been getting a lot of press, but yesterday was a big day for conservation. President Trump signed into law the Great American Outdoors Act, and the proponents of this act, and it was widely supported across the aisle in Congress, and it went to President Trump's desk, and he signed it into law yesterday. The proponents are calling this the biggest conservation legislation in probably 50 years. It's a big deal, and it provides nearly $3 billion a year to do several important things. First of all, it will guarantee indefinite and permanent, essentially permanent funding of the Popular Land and Water Conservation Fund, which Wisconsin has gotten a lot of money out of over the years. It also addresses the maintenance backlog that's been facing our national parks and public lands for years, which is huge. Now, some people who are kind of naysayers suggest, well, the backlog has been estimated at $20 billion. This isn't enough, and it probably isn't, but it's a heck of a good start. And there's also a big chunk of money, about $900 million a year in the conservation fund that will be shared amongst a number of agencies. So it's a great thing, and a lot of people are really happy about it. It will provide permanent funding for some things that have gone wanting in recent years. So it's
good
a good
news.
Deal. It's
yeah.
a good deal. And, you know, Wisconsin's outdoor recreation programs are valued at about $17 or $18 billion to the state. This is an opportunity to keep those healthy, and that's a very good thing.
Let's take another call, Scott. Barb in St. Germain has a question for us. Barb, hello. What's on your mind? Barb, are you there?
Hello? Dennis in Two Rivers.
Oh, Dennis in Two Rivers. Well, all right. We'll go to you as long as you're there. Hi.
Okay, I heard the beep of the other one. Okay. I've in the 50 years my family has had this lot, I've never seen so many frogs in my neighbors and I are wondering, well, are they coming up from a river that's about half a mile away? Or maybe if there was some big puddle or temporary pond, but there's like a dozen or so frogs on my lot, and I'm having trouble avoiding them when I'm mowing my lawn. So I was wondering, do you have any tips on how to coax them out of the way so I can mow my lawn?
Are you talking, do you know what kind of frogs they are, Dennis, or is it?
Yeah, they're leopard frogs.
Leopard frogs.
Well, I don't know how old they are. So if like they're just from this year, or because I don't know how quickly they grow.
Well, leopard frogs will really cover ground, so they may have metamorphosed or left their breeding pond a long ways away from you, and leopard frogs will also live quite well away from water in moist wetlands and whatnot, and so you'll see them where you don't expect to see them. The good news is, as far as your mowing, they're very fast. I mean, they can jump like mad, and most of them are going to avoid the mower. In my case, as I was mowing yesterday, I've had a tremendous emergence of toads from my little water garden, and they're all over the place, and they're very slow moving and don't hop very well. So I was having trouble getting on and off the tractor to move them out of the way. I think you'll have... The bottom line, Dennis, is that in a big year for amphibians, like we talked about earlier, these things are going to be all over the place by the thousands. And unfortunately, mowing and road traffic and just normal day-to-day activities is going to exact a toll on them, but there's really not much you can do about that. If you've got to mow. I would tend to do your mowing during the heat of midday, when the frogs presumably have retreated to a shady or moist area, and that may minimize your collateral damage. But
yeah, well, they tend to hop toward toward the long grass, which of course is where I end up mowing. I mow the lawn. The grass is short, so then they hop to the longer grass. No, they should do the opposite.
Well, depending on how much you've got to mow, or if you've got some helpers around in the form of kids or whatever, you could get them running around in the tall grass to try and get them out of the way. But realistically, Dennis, there's not a great deal you can do. You've got to mow. Hopefully most of them get out of the way. There's not much else you can do.
Okay,
Yeah,
okay,
thank you. Barb in St. Germain. Now we'll go to you. Hi, Barb.
Hi, Larry and Scott. I saw a hummingbird about 3 weeks ago that is the size and shape of a ruby-throated hummingbird. It was sitting on a shepherd's crook that holds a hanging plant in front of my kitchen window. But instead of a red throat, it just had a white spot on the white patch on its throat. And it had a triangular-shaped piece of sulfur yellow on each side of the bird, you know, where the normal coloring might be on the head of a hummingbird. And I've never seen a hummingbird like that before. We only feed hummingbirds at this time of year, and we have so many that we have to refill our feeders every day. And I looked through I only have a Peterson's field guide, and there was nothing like that in there. And I was looking at the hummingbird from the front, so it looked like a thin, the thin edge of a wedge going backward and just sulfur yellow on each side of its throat, and the throat itself, just the white patch.
Well, okay, so what we established earlier in the program about the violet ear hummingbird is that unusual hummingbirds do get here, and hummingbird, generally speaking, the party line is that the hummingbirds in Wisconsin are all ruby-throated hummingbirds. And so you can become a hummingbird expert because the odds are 999 out of 1,000 that any hummingbird you see is going to be a ruby-throat. Now, the way the light hits the birds, ruby-throats may look like they have a brilliant ruby throat, or they may look black. So that compounds the identification. However, there are other species that find their way here. For example, we get a fair number of records of rufous hummingbirds, and there are others. Most of these are western or southwestern species, and if you have Peterson's Field Guide to Birds of the Eastern United States, they aren't going to show up. So look at the western version field guide, and you may see something that looks like what you were seeing. That's about the only suggestion I have, because I don't know what it was from the description. But and the other issue is there are always plumage anomalies in some of these common birds due to injury or genetics or whatever. So it could go either way. But it sounds like you've got a really good look at it. Look in a field guide to the western birds where there'll be more hummingbirds and see if you find it there. Okay?
There you go. Thank you, Barb. Appreciate it. Brian in Marquette County. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good afternoon. I have an odd question. Here in Marquette County, the Nina Creek runs through the county, and my granddaughters a week or so ago were swimming in the creek, and they pulled up an elk shed antler that has been there for a long time. Is it possible that it has been there many, many, many years?
It's possible. I can't imagine that anyone would dispose of an elk shed that they harvested in Montana, for example, 2 years ago. They're prized possessions. But there are records in the Zoology Museum and other museums in Wisconsin of elk antlers that have been buried in the mud in a creek or lake or whatever for many, many years since elk, before they were restored to the state back in 1995, but we're talking back 100 or 200 years or more, and that elk shed has been protected down in the mud and water of Nina Creek for that long. That's the most likely explanation. There's a beautiful elk rack on display in the Zoology Museum that was fished out of, I think it was Lake Wingra, by somebody who snagged it on their boat anchor years ago and dredged it up off the bottom. And that had been there since elk were roaming Wisconsin quite a long time ago. So that's probably what they found. It's a really cool find, Brian, and you should report it to, let's see, I'm trying to think of a local nature center over there, but if not the nature center or museum, take it to a DNR office and document where it was found and when, and that's really a cool specimen. It's not quite a mastodon tusk, but hey, it's close.
It's sort of Wisconsin's mastodon tusk.
Yep. So that's a really neat find.
Yeah, it really is. Shoot us a picture of it, Brian. I'd love to see a photo of it myself. It'd be kind of fun to see. Just go to ideas at wpr.org/Larry, and you can do that.
Say, Larry?
Yeah.
Larry, there was one I probably won't get any help from the listeners now at this late time in the program, but I did want to ask the listeners, and maybe they can send something in that Jill can hang on to for me, if they've ever seen a case of gray squirrels digging up turtle nests and eating the eggs. I'm really curious about that. I've been trying to find records of that because I've got a really, locally important turtle nesting site at my cabin. And when I was up there this past weekend, I found between 25 and 30 nests that had all been very delicately dug up and all the eggs eaten, and the shells were lying around. And the next two mornings that I happened to be there, a squirrel came out of the woods and very diligently visited each of these sites, sniffing around the nest. I didn't see him doing anything, and the only nest that survived was one where I saw the turtle laying the eggs back in June and protected it with a wire dome. That one's still intact. But we often blame raccoons and possums and skunks and whatnot for nest depredations. I'm suspicious of this squirrel. Squirrels will eat bird eggs, and I'm just wondering if anybody else has ever seen this. So I just wanted to get that out there and see what people had to say.
Well, I'd not heard of that, but, I mean, certainly sounds plausible. It's another one of those mysteries, Scott, that we're going to have to deal with the next time you're on the air. But if we get some emails, we'll certainly, Jill, I know we'll pass those on to you because that's really interesting. Well, here we are out of time. Scott, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today. And you're back on October 7th.
Wow. I hope there's some good news on the COVID front by then. Take care, Larry.
Thank you, Scott. Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, back Wednesday, October 7th. Well, thank you so much for listening today. Tomorrow we'll be talking about the latest scams from our Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection experts. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. Please stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mehler.